You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to The Ready Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and here with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including TNG and HD, a Star Trek Red Sea resort, and rating all the Star Trek movies, 1 through 11. We'll also have an interview with Star Trek author and historian Larry Nemechek, talking about the failed Houston convention known as the Con of Wrath. And we'll also be talking about the future of Star Trek on television. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How is everything up there today?
Oh, it's great. It's, you know, rained all weekend, but now it's actually starting to begin to look like it could be nice in the future. So,
in the future,
yeah,
that would be nice. We're fully into Tsuyu, or the rainy season, here. So it's just kind of this continuous mist here today. I'm glad I'm inside.
Yeah, me too.
And nothing better inside than to talk about some Star Trek news.
Yeah.
And we've got quite a few little items in the news this week that we'll talk about. And the first one is not exactly Star Trek related, but The Hobbit.
Yeah, somewhat.
Is coming out. Finally, Warner Brothers has released some information on the two Hobbit movies. Mm-hmm. We have titles and we have release dates. And the first, I guess, the Star Trek tie-in here is with the possibility that J.J.'s film may still come out for a holiday 2012 release.
Right.
Or it may be a holiday 2012 release when it comes out as opposed to summer. We're looking at the possibility of it going up against one of the Hobbit movies.
Exactly. Like we talked last episode about Nemesis going up against, I believe it was The Two Towers in December 2002.
Yeah.
And so we might...
As well as a Harry Potter film.
And there was a Harry Potter film, I think Chamber of Secrets. So we're possibly going to run into the same sort of issue this time. Although, as we said, they're different films, and Star Trek seems to be a bigger thing, a bigger deal now anyway, so might not be a big deal that they're butting heads in the holiday season.
Do you think there's going to be as much anticipation for these Hobbit movies as there was for Lord of the Rings?
Well, you know, I expected the first project he did after Lord of the Rings was King Kong, and I thought that was going to be huge, you know, the next big thing. And I was there midnight. I loved the film. And the theater was empty, and no one saw the film, and I was really surprised. And then he made this other film, The Lovely Bones, which no one cared about either. So it's kind of obvious that people don't care too much about Peter Jackson as a name.
Yeah, it's just the Lord of the Rings.
Right, so the question is...
As opposed to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the question is the Lord of the Rings, does that also encompass The Hobbit? Are people going to connect the two in their head and say, you know, I've got to go see this one because I've seen all the Lord of the Rings films?
You mean the general audience?
The general audience.
Not people who read The Hobbit the Rings novels.
I'm sure the diehards will be there.
Yeah.
The ones who wear elf ears and such.
So we're looking at the first movie, December 14th, 2012, mm-hmm. and then the second one is December 13th, 2013, which, yep, of course, has no impact on Star Trek. But I just wanted to ask you, and then we'll get on to Star Trek. Mm. The names came out, because we have our titles for Star Trek movies, and what did you think about these names?
Well, I believe the second one, which is There and Back Again, is the alternate title for The Hobbit.
Okay.
And then the first one, I believe, is the name of the first chapter of the book.
Okay.
So they're going pretty basic, just let's name it stuff from the original books and not try to be too creative,
yeah,
which is good. But they're, An Unexpected Journey is kind of a little bit hard to say for me.
Well, I ask because I saw them and it said An Unexpected Journey, and the first thing that I heard in my head was The Undiscovered Country.
Right.
And I thought, this sounds kind of like a Star Trek movie.
This is
An
true.
Unexpected Journey. It's kind of like what happened in Mirror, Mirror. They beamed up to the ship and they went on an unexpected journey.
There we go.
Through the lightning storm. Okay, well, so I guess my feeling, whether this first release would have much impact on a Star Trek movie, but probably not. I think I think there's certainly room over a holiday period for mm-hmm. several big films in the theater. And as we said last week, I think the last JJ film was so big that there's going to be a lot of anticipation for that.
Right.
And, you know, it's been quite a few years since the Lord of the Rings were around. It's taken them so long to get to The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
I think the anticipation from the Lord of the Rings has pretty much dissipated in terms of people rushing to the box office.
I think you're right about that.
So I think there will be much more momentum from the last Star Trek film in 2009.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
well,
be interesting to see.
Yeah, we'll see. So let's move on to the next topic. Another rumor that's been going around for a few weeks is the possibility of The Next Generation being remastered in HD. There are kind of two angles to this. One is the HD angle and a Blu-ray release, and then tied into that is the possibility of remastering the digital effects and perhaps some of the other CGI, the way they did for the original series.
Right. And I guess the difficulty with doing next-gen in HD as opposed to the original series is something I should talk about. So the original series was entirely shot on film. The show itself was shot on film, the effects were shot on film, and was all edited on film. So those masters were in a vault somewhere, and just like the original Star Wars movies, it just has to be taken out of the vault, cleaned up, and then reprinted. And what they found when they did the original series was that the effects did not hold up. They were second and third generation, very scratchy. They just did not look good in HD, so they said, oh, look, let's just redo the effects using computer effects, try to replicate the look of the show while making it look clean as the shots of the bridge were.
And so you're talking about the original DVD release.
Original DVD release, the original HD broadcast of
Not the
TOS.
Remastered project to bring the effects up to date for a modern audience.
Well, that was for the original series.
For the original
is
series.
Is what they did, yes.
Yeah.
So then I'm sure they want to do this as well for next gen because, you know, if you watch those on DVD, it's that low quality look that we've been watching.
Yeah, because, you know, I was watching some of the first season today, actually, because I was going through and trying to look for elements where I think they need attention to the effects.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the attention needed to the effects, just the overall image quality, there's a lot of noise in the image. It's very, this is off DVD, too.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't aged very well.
Yeah, definitely. So, again, they could do the same thing they did with the original series and pull the film negative out of the vault and clean it up. The difficulty is the late 80s and then the early 90s, and video started being used in visual effects. And you can't clean up video. It's, you know, just magnets on tape. So any shot, you know, showing the view screen, any of the effects shots, anything, you know, where Q snaps his fingers and disappears, that's only exists on video now. So they could...
So they were taking the video and the film, they're kind of splicing this together. So we have some moments that are just the everyday stuff is... Everyday scenes are film, but then when there's an effect, they're splicing video-only footage in...
That's exactly correct.
...with the film to create a cohesive episode.
Right. So it would be a big deal to go through and find the original negatives and actually redo all the effects. Like even, like I say, Q disappearing anytime the view screen is shown. And then all of the model shots, even, of the Enterprise, which were shot on film but then were transferred to video to composite in the stars or any phaser effects.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that would have to be redone in HD, and it would be a bigger project than it was for the original series.
Well, that's interesting, because I think that most people, just because one show was shot in the late 60s, one was shot in the late 80s, early 90s, would think that cleaning up TOS would have been the bigger project. But because of technology, it's actually a bit more challenging to do TNG.
Exactly.
And this would be a pretty costly project for CBS.
Yeah.
So I know I've heard they've been doing some tests on the feasibility of the project, and costs have been a concern.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, do you think that NextGen has the interest behind it? I mean, TOS has sort of the nostalgic appeal. Do you think Next Gen has the same sort of appeal that it would sell?
Well, I think that amongst fans, there is an appeal for this. I personally would love to see some really, really clean copies of the next generation with the visual effects updated. Mm-hmm. As the series goes on, the need to update the visual effects decreases a bit because as you got towards season 6 and 7, mm-hmm. The technology that the studio had access to mm-hmm. had improved quite a bit. Right. But if you go back to season 1, it's better than the original series effects, of course, but for what we're accustomed to now, especially last week we were talking about Enterprise and how beautifully done Enterprise was. And if you watch that and then you go back and you watch the first few seasons of The Next Generation, you really feel how dated the show was from a technological standpoint of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think there's an interest, but what I wonder is, okay, so I think a lot of fans have all of the DVD box sets for The Next Generation. So I already dished out money for these DVD box sets a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, would I go back and buy them again on Blu-ray mm-hmm. to get a cleaner copy and updated visual effects? Right. And, you know, I don't know, because I still don't actually own the remastered TOS on Blu-ray. I want it. I would like to buy it. But the price point for me right now, when I already own the original series box sets in their original DVD release, it's kind of tough for me to say, okay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to dish out more money to buy the same episodes that I already have just because they updated the effects.
Yep.
At some point, I'm going to do it.
Right.
But it's not something that I'm rushing out to do. And I think that TNG, because the difference between the original and what we will get from a remastered won't be as great as what we have in TOS, it could be a hard sell.
Mm. One thing I did want to mention before we go is that it's not entirely about the DVD sales. They're also keeping in mind the syndication rights. And as many more of these cable stations that like to show Star Trek, they're switching over to showing more and more HD content. They're going to start to balk at wanting to show Next Gen in, you know, that boxed off, very dated looking image. So if they did this HD remastering, it would make it a lot easier to sell the show as a cable show, or even show it on some of the networks.
Like that's a very good point. And that could be what pushes the studio to actually go ahead and do it. And also there's the Netflix streaming.
Right.
With all the Star Trek shows streaming on Netflix. So,
yeah
definitely. And they might see that. Plus, when JJ's next film comes out, mm-hmm. that could be a good release point where they might be able to capitalize on the publicity of Star Trek at that time to launch something like this.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a next story that we have... is about a resort being built in Jordan on the Red Sea.
Yeah, I was just astonished by this. It's like a Star Trek resort in the middle of the Middle East.
Well, it seems that it's not exactly a Star Trek resort as much as it's a resort that will have a Star Trek component.
Right.
But that's interesting in and of itself. And this is along the Red Sea, and it's mm-hmm. being built by the Rubicon Group Holding... in conjunction with Paramount Recreation. Mm. And it's called the Red Sea Astrarium.
Mm.
And the concept of it says that it is going to offer an immersive entertainment experience.
Yeah.
Along with 5-star accommodations, theatrical productions, nighttime spectacles, dining, and shopping. Now, I don't know if the theatrical productions would include any kind of Star Trek show, but that might be interesting if it did.
Yeah. Well, I know there's that new Harry Potter theme park. I forget where that is, but there's that one. And there's also, is it still around, Star Trek The Experience?
It actually closed down.
That's what I thought.
I don't remember the exact year, but just sometime in the past couple of years, it closed down.
Yeah.
So in Las Vegas.
I'd love to see something like the Harry Potter Resort done as Star Trek. And I don't know if this is quite it, but I wanted to put this in the news because... I would love to, you know, go on the bridge of the Star Trek, of the Enterprise, or I don't know, go through the captain's galley of the NX-01, or, you know, all these different sets that I've seen on film. I'd love to actually go into them. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but, you know, maybe if Star Trek gets big enough.
Well, it would be an interesting experience. And this one is, it says, okay, you know, here in Japan we have we have Disney Sea. Mm-hmm. A lot of people outside Japan don't know this. We have a theme park right next to Disneyland called Tokyo Disney Sea. Right. And the description of this reminds me a lot of that. It's kind
Is that
of
right?
It feels like that kind of park where you have the different themed areas based on different cultures. Mm-hmm. Not in the way Epcot is. It's a bit different feeling than that.
Okay.
And this says that it's going to focus on different themed parts of history.
Okay.
Including Babylonian, British, Roman. And what the Star Trek component is the future. The section focusing on future history is represented by Star Trek.
Oh, that's really interesting. So they're sort of buying into Star Trek as being, this is what the future really will be. That's interesting.
Yeah, I guess so. And it says that it's going to be inspired by the JJ movie.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Maybe that they feel that look is maybe the more updated look for Star Trek. I don't know, for the audience. You know, a connection here, if you're wondering why it's in Jordan, you may remember that King Abdullah... Mm-hmm. Actually appeared in an episode of Voyager.
Is that
in
right?
1996, I didn't know that. Jordan's King Abdullah. He was in the Voyager episode Investigations, mm-hmm. and he was just a background Starfleet crewman. But he's a Star Trek fan, and it was a big, you know,
oh, wow.
honor for him to actually take part in Star Trek. And so that's a little bit of the Jordanian connection there, because oh. I know otherwise... Might seem a little bit odd at first why there is a resort in Jordan having a Star Trek themed area, but there is some connection.
Okay, so maybe if we elect J.J. Abrams, say, as governor of California, he'll build me one of my Star Trek theme parks.
Oh, maybe.
In San Diego. All right, I will put that on my to-do list.
Okay, let's do that. All right. Well, the next bit of news that we have here, this is a pretty interesting one. This was a thing called Trekathon. And a Trekathon was a group of 23 fans that got together and they screened all 11 Star Trek films over the course of 2 days. Mm. And they rated these films from 0 to 10,
right.
with 10 being perfect.
Right. And I should mention, one of these fans is my friend Brian Finisfer, who is from the Down in Front podcast over at downinfront.net.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought was one of your friends involved in this. Mm. And the ratings are kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk for a minute and see if we agree with the ratings or not. And our listeners, let us know if you agree with the ratings
please
or
do.
Not as well. You can contact us through the Trek FM website, trek.fm/contact. Yeah. And first, they screened the motion picture. They may have screamed also at the time.
I certainly did.
Why
watching
are you wearing
recently?
Pastels? But the first was the motion picture, and I was a little surprised here, sort of surprised, I guess, watching it now in 2011, that they gave the motion picture an overall rating of 7.2. Now, what do you think about that?
Now, I would wonder if they watched the original or the director's cut. Because I don't think anyone liked the original at all, even the director. I watched it recently.
He was not happy with it.
I was extremely disappointed watching that one recently. But I remember seeing the director's cut and thinking it moved along a little bit better. And because some of the effects had been updated, it looked a lot more impressive.
Yeah. I always watch the director's cut these days. I guess, glutton for punishment, I go back every once, a couple times a year and rewatch the motion picture. I don't know. It does hold up better than the original cut.
Right.
But it's just such a plodding movie.
It is.
I think it really lacks direction.
Yeah.
I personally would probably give it about a 5.
Yeah, I'd probably put it around a 5. Yeah. I think if it had been the first episode of Phase 2, could have worked. As a movie, it's probably more like a 5.
Yeah, as an episode, if they did it for 45 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, might. So Star Trek II is next, and of course, as most fans would agree, one of the best Star Trek movies. And they gave that a 9.36 on average.
Oh yeah, and I think that's spot on. I'd probably give it a 9.95. It's not a perfect film, but Khan is such a great villain, and I didn't actually realize this the last time I saw it, but that was the first time we saw a Starfleet ship that was not Constitution class. So it expanded the Star Trek universe by showing the Valiant and another bridge.
Yeah, it did. So. And yeah, I agree with you there. I'm probably like a 9.5 on that. Good movie, moves along really well.
Yep.
And it's something that you didn't need to be a Star Trek fan to enjoy that movie.
Exactly.
So really good filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek III, this one's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, they gave it an 8.18. And I'm the kind of person that I like these middle... I know that when they made Star Trek II, they weren't setting out to make a trilogy, but they ended up making a trilogy. And I'm the kind of person, like in Star Wars, I like The Empire Strikes Back. I like these kind of middle parts to stories. So I really enjoyed Star Trek III myself. I'm especially fond of the whole sequence of stealing the Enterprise.
Yep.
So what do you think?
I was pleasantly surprised on I believe I saw it last week, went back and watched again. And I really actually liked this movie. It's probably slightly below 2 on my level. I liked the villain. The plot line of Spock being brought back to life is extremely hokey, and I wish they had either not killed him or left him dead. But other than that, I think the film really works much better than I thought it did.
Yeah, it does. I think their rating is pretty... I'd probably give it around an 8, maybe. Mm. It's a film that I rewatch it a lot. I just really like that movie. I wouldn't put it up there with Wrath of Khan in terms of overall film quality, but it's a good movie.
I will say, if they'd been able to bring Kirstie Alley back, it would raise my rating at least half a point, maybe a full point.
Yeah, I agree. Not only for Kirstie Alley, but I also don't like when a character is... The actor is changed on a character. So then we move on to The Voyage Home. They gave that an 8.16, which was... It kind of surprised me that it was just right on par with 3 with this group of fans, because it's... For the overall movie audience... I feel it's one of the most popular movies.
It is.
And I know for you, it's really your favorite movie. So tell us if you agree with this 8.16 rating on Voyage Home.
All right. I need to go back and watch 4 again. I'll admit, I actually skipped it in my last marathon. I don't like these episodes where they go back to modern time, whether it was Future's End on Voyager or the... There was a season 3 episode of Enterprise where they went back to
past tense on... Well, past tense on DS9, they didn't go all the way back to our present day, but
not quite.
They went back in time to San Francisco.
I'm not a fan of these episodes, but the thing that kills for me is that it doesn't have the Enterprise. Okay, they have the Enterprise at the very end, but most of the film, they're on this Klingon ship, and they're in 1986... And it's just not Star Trek for me.
Yeah, I get that. And the Enterprise really is one of the main characters.
Exactly.
In Star Trek. So you were kind of missing a main character there.
I mean, it's like if you tried to make a Harry Potter film without Hogwarts. Oh, wait.
Do you think, though, that The Voyage Home, after the heaviness of 2 and especially 3... Do you think it was, last week we were talking about in Enterprise how after the Zindi, they had home.
Right.
They went back home. And in Next Generation, after the Best of Both Worlds, they had family. And so here you have 2 films that are very heavy, and then you have this very lighthearted film to kind of wrap it up.
I think it's great they did a lighthearted film. It obviously really connected with fans. It really helped the Next Generation happen. But as a part of the whole, I don't think it's quite as good. And if we can go ahead and start talking about 5.
Yeah, so let's go into 5.
4 really influenced the lighthearted nature of the Five script.
Oh, it did. And yeah. I think in a negative way.
In a negative way. So why don't you tell us what they thought of
Five? Okay, well, their rating, their average rating for Five was 4.07. Mm. And if I remember correctly, everyone, you can actually go to YouTube, and we'll put a link to this here in the show notes for this show. You can watch the group and see each individual person's ratings. And I believe there were a number of ones given for Five. And my feeling on Five is I hated it when it first came out. I love the score is great. I love the orchestral score. The movie itself, I really didn't like the movie. I've rewatched it many times over the years. I just rewatched it recently, and I've come to kind of like the story concept, but it was executed really poorly. And what you just said about Four influencing the lighthearted nature of Five is that Four worked. The comedy in Four worked for me because it naturally evolved from their situation.
Right.
And in Five, there you can see every time there is an intentional effort on the writers to inject some kind of humor into the story. It's so forced and it comes off as very cheesy. And I think it is part of what spoils the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Anytime something interesting starts to happen or something serious starts to happen, someone cracks a joke from out of nowhere, and it's usually not a very funny joke. Like the opening scene where Kirk is rock climbing.
Yeah.
And it's just every line is supposed to be funny, and the whole thing just doesn't work. And it really spoils the rest of the film. There are actually some interesting concepts, like you talk about. Although, what do you think of having Spock's brother or half-brother?
I didn't like that. I didn't really like that. I'm not sure how I would have done that differently off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I don't like the introduction. I kind of felt this way in Wrath of Khan too, when David came on. Okay. I don't like the introduction of these unknown family members.
Right.
We had that with Picard in, was it season 7, which was like the family season of Next Generation, where we find out that Picard maybe has this son that comes on the ship.
Right.
And I think he turns out not to be right, but
I think so.
But for most of the episode, it's presented that way. I don't like these out of the blue family members showing up.
Right.
So I kind of felt that way, you know, with Cybok there as well. But that's not even the only thing
that's
going on.
That's
in Five.
So I think the biggest problem is the humor that goes off course, and the ending doesn't quite work, I think.
Well, and you've got that Klingon who's supposed to be the big foe, who looks like he stepped out of a Twisted Sister concert or something. I mean, the makeup, it's, you can't get much more 80s than what was going on right there. It was just an unfortunate film in general. But it's possible someone can take that story and actually turn that into a good film.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about Five at length in a future feature.
Yeah, we should do that. So let's jump ahead then to Six. Mm-hmm. And they gave Six the same rating they gave Four, which was an 8.16.
Yep.
Which is interesting to me because these are quite different films, but they are films that I also kind of hold to right around the same place in my rankings, even though they're very, very different in terms of their subject matter. What do you think about this 8.16 for The Undiscovered Country?
Six is the only Star Trek film for me that hits the nail on the head as far as social commentary and really saying the world is like this and we should think about it differently and think about how we can change the world. I think Insurrection tries to do that to some extent. And a lot of DS9, a lot of the best DS9 did that sort of thing. Where the real, what I like about a lot of sci-fi is where it makes us look at the world. And that's what I like about Six.
Yeah, same here. That's what I like about Star Trek and sci-fi in general as well. Okay, so let's move on into the Next Generation movies. Mm-hmm. And we get into Generations. And this group gave Generations a 6.57, which, for me, I think I probably rate Generations a little bit higher. I might give it about a 7.5 or so. Mm-hmm. But I, this rating does not surprise me in terms of the fan base.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Generations is looked down upon. You know, it had the death of Kirk. It sort of shoehorned the original series cast into a movie where it really was a next-gen movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've listened to the DVD commentary with Ronald Moore and Brendan Braga, the writers, talking about how they were sort of given a few directives by the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And with the death of Kirk, and I believe being one of them, or at least having Kirk in the movie being one of the directives, I think they made the best movie they could, given the direction. And I really enjoy the film. I enjoy it every time I watch it. I think the next-gen cast makes the leap to the big screen really well. It's a better film than the motion picture was.
Oh, well, most definitely there.
And
oh, that's what I find curious, too, that the group gave the motion picture 7.2, but they gave Generations 6.57.
Really odd to me.
And Generations is a much better film than the motion picture.
I think it's backlash. I think it's backlash over the death of Kirk.
Yeah.
And it sort of feels fan fiction-y in a way, and I can understand that.
Do you feel like the... I think one thing, as we move into First Contact, I think one thing that they did that was important in First Contact is that they redesigned the ship, they redid the uniforms, they brought everything up to date for what you need to do on a big screen.
That's true.
Whereas in Generations, they held on to the Enterprise D. They couldn't make up their minds about the uniforms.
You've got this weird
mix of the DS9 jumpsuits and the TNG more officer uniforms going on, which is just looks weird on camera for me.
Well, they did have a full redesign, didn't they? They were going to go with a completely new uniform. And then
for First Contact, they did.
I believe, I'll have to look this up and put it in the show notes. I believe they had a full redesign planned and then decided they didn't, but they weren't going to go that direction. But at that point, they didn't have the time, I think, to do anything. So they ended up having just use whatever uniforms they had laying around.
Well, that might be the case because they really rushed into Generations.
Yes.
I think they started shooting it like the following week after they shot All Good Things.
Maybe. It's weird. They were making those like almost at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were writing the script for All Good Things and Generations at the same time.
Right.
And I've heard Moore and Braga talking about how they had to keep everything straight in their heads.
Yeah.
Which script are we working on here? So they really did rush into Generations.
Yeah.
So certainly there would have been no time to do full costume redesigns.
Right. I still think it holds up as a movie. It's a 7.5 or 8. It's definitely one of the better Star Trek films, I think.
Yeah, 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 I agree. And so First Contact, we just mentioned the full redesign of
the ship uniforms
and everything, and they gave that a 9.36, which puts it right tied with The Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much agree. You know, I cannot distinguish these two movies for myself. When I try to rank them, I really can't. You know, I almost think First Contact is a better movie than The Wrath of Khan. But I have very nostalgic feelings about The Wrath of Khan, having grown up with TOS.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to separate them. So I don't really try to separate them because, for me, Wrath of Khan is the best original cast movie. First Contact is the best TNG movie.
Right. I think I would actually give the edge to First Contact. And let me try to explain why. Because First Contact delves into the history of Star Trek more, I love that we go back and see the guy who invented warp drive and actually see the first warp flight. I mean, that's just really great. I love that sort of thing where we see Trek history. And as an action movie, they're sort of on the same level. They both are very suspenseful. They're both shot very well. They both have great villains. But as far as being a big Star Trek movie that shows a lot of new things, First Contact does that better than Khan did.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I agree with that. So First Contact, I think most fans agree. They may not agree that First Contact has an edge over Wrath of Khan, but they agree that First Contact is one of the best Star Trek movies,
right.
Which takes us into Insurrection.
Yep.
And this kind of surprised me here because this group, I expected them to rate Insurrection on the lower end. Mm-hmm. But I didn't expect them to give it the lowest rating of any Star Trek film, including 5, and they gave it an average rating of 3.
Yeah.
And there were so many 1s in that group, 1s and 2s. I think this 3 may have been skewed because somebody gave it an 8 or something, because right. It was just like 1, 2, 3 across the board.
Yeah, I actually kind of love Insurrection. This is another one I really want to do as a feature. It's almost a great Star Trek film. And as I watch it, I can sort of fuzz around the edges and pretend that it's the movie I want it to be. I don't understand giving it a 3.
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
It's not worse than Star Trek 5. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah, I don't get it either. I really don't get the 3 rating there. You know, I probably give Insurrection about a 7 maybe, mm-hmm. something in that area.
Yeah.
It's good Star Trek. Mm-hmm. It was a letdown after First Contact.
So. Sure.
After that box office box office flop that Insurrection was, the studio decided to try one more time, and they put out Nemesis.
And there was a long break between Insurrection and Nemesis.
It was
4 or 5 years.
It was like 4 years or maybe even 5, yeah. And so this group gave Nemesis a 4.25, which I don't agree with if I'm just rating it as a movie. Mm. But again, I understand fans mm-hmm. having that feeling about this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess whereas Insurrection was a good next-gen episode on the big screen, Nemesis was an okay action movie. So it's not really Star Trek. It's especially not really next-gen. But it does have some good action sequences, and it has a few interesting ideas going on. I definitely think it's the worst next-gen movie. I'd probably give it a 5 or a 6.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm probably with you on that. Maybe 5 or 6. Yeah. Okay, and then the last one is the most recent movie, the J.J. Abrams movie, mm-hmm. and they gave that an 8.53.
Right.
Which puts it, I think, third.
Yeah.
We have Wrath of Khan, First Contact, tied for first with this group. J.J. Mm-hmm. Abrams' Star Trek from 2009 comes in third, 8.53. Mm-hmm.
I believe this is going to... I need to pull up the sheet, but I believe... Yes, my friend Brian is the one bringing that total down, because he actually rated the film a 4.
Wow.
While there's many 10s and many 9s and many 8s, and there's a 7 and then his 4.
Okay.
I think in general, people love this movie.
Yeah. I think the general audience, I think, loved it. I think newer Star Trek fans who came in, mm-hmm. especially on Voyager... Maybe fans who came in on Next Generation as well really enjoy this movie. I think hardcore TOS fans have a real problem with this movie.
Yeah.
And any time you have 23 Star Trek fans together in a group, you're going to have quite a mix, and you're going to have some hardcore TOS fans as well.
Right.
And I'm a huge TOS fan. I grew up with TOS. Mm. I'm not quite as hardcore. I'm not quite as much on the purity of the creative, I think, as some fans are, because I do like to see things evolve, and as long as they're doing it in an alternate timeline, no matter how convoluted that might seem to some people, I really don't have any problem with seeing how events might have unfolded differently.
Yeah,
because you can think of it that way. This is how things might have unfolded. It doesn't erase what we had before, but this is a new course of events. So.
Right.
Yeah. I wouldn't give it a 10 because I just don't give anything a 10 very easily. but I'd probably give it a 9.
Yeah. Well, again, this is a good feature we should talk about. I give this film a 10 because of the opening scene. The opening with on the... What was the ship called? I should
it
know
was
this.
The Kelvin.
Thank you. The Kelvin. And seeing Kirk's father and the birth of James Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It moves me like almost to tears every time I see it.
Yeah. And it did have a great opening.
Yeah. The rest of the film, you have to remember that it was written and then the writer's strike happened and they couldn't fix some of the script problems that it really does have. And it is a little convoluted. I don't know. As a movie, I enjoy it. If you really break it down, it starts to fall apart.
that's a good point about the strike, because I think people remember that happening, but they might not quite connect the two things because it was fairly recent. But it was quite in the news at the time that Star Trek was shooting, that you know, JJ had even mentioned that well, we have the writer's strike, so you know, there are some things that we would like to tweak, but we can't. But I don't think it hurt things too much.
I don't think it did. It's definitely a solid, at least a 9.5, if not a 10, for that opening scene.
So while we're on the topic of movies, let's just jump to another news story here. StarTrek.com has just published an interview with Malcolm McDowell, who played Sorin in Generations. Yeah. And we were just talking about how Generations worked as a film. And one of the sore spots for a lot of fans is the death of Kirk.
Right.
And obviously one of the questions that McDowell is asked in here is, how did he feel about being the guy who killed Kirk? What did you think about, McDowell's character of Sorin in the film? What did you think about his role in the demise of the beloved Captain Kirk?
Right. I think as a villain, obviously I have to put him into the category of guys rather than captains that are villains in Star Trek movies.
These are our Star Trek guys.
Exactly. This is
we're going to become known for the guys.
I hope so. Anyway, he was one of the guys, but he was one of the stronger guys. And I think he makes a really interesting villain. And I love that they cast Malcolm McDowell.
Well, he was perfect for that role. Yeah. Just absolutely perfect, I will say.
I didn't see Clockwork Orange until years after I saw Generations, but he is such the perfect actor to bring that crazy but extremely intelligent and focused villain to the film. So I don't have a problem with him in the movie. The way they ended up killing Kirk, I think, was a problem. And this is McDowell talks about it. You know, they shot it and it was kind of lame, and then they went through all this trouble to reshoot it, and it was still lame.
Yeah, that's right. Because in the interview, he says that if you have this icon of American television, why didn't you give him a spectacular death?
Yeah.
And instead, it was just a really paltry death. Yeah. And it was. The way that it happened on camera was especially just... It wasn't appropriate for everything that Captain Kirk had meant to Star Trek.
Yeah.
And all the times that he had skirted death. For him to die that way was... It didn't make any sense to me. It didn't... I didn't leave the theater angry that Kirk was dead. Although I still remember seeing this movie in the theater and watching grown men weeping in the theater that Kirk had died. I don't know if they were weeping because Kirk had died or they were weeping because of the way that the writers had killed him and they wanted their money back for their tickets. I don't know. Yeah. But what we saw on screen, now that wasn't the only, that was not the original way he died.
Now I'd like us to put the original version is on YouTube. I hope that'll be in the show notes. And I guess what appeals to me about the original ending was it was even more shocking of a death. Like, he's shot in the back by Sorin and then just sort of dies. Whereas when they did the reshoot, they tried to make it more heroic, but didn't actually make it more heroic. Let me see if I can explain. The original ending was kind of a gut punch. Whereas the reshot one felt like it was trying to send him off gloriously and completely failing.
Yeah, trying to. But...
Right. And so I'd rather they did it honestly and said, you know what, Kirk doesn't get a glorious death. He's just going to die. Just some guy's going to shoot him in the back and he's gone. I'd rather they did it that way than sort of half-ass it the way they did in the finished version.
Right. And, you know, the other thing here, too, from a continuity standpoint, anyway, is that we know from Star Trek V that Kirk, he says he's always known that he would die alone, right? But Picard is there with him.
I know.
So he wasn't alone.
Yeah.
Yet he died. I mean, it's not a big deal, but just it seems like the kind of thing that if you're going to give Kirk a send-off, and this has been established previously, just follow through with that.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen them just follow through with that.
Well, maybe you can pretend that he died on the Enterprise B saving the ship, and that Kirk defeated Soren all by himself.
Yeah.
At least that's what history recorded, so we can pretend it's true as well.
All right. Well, let's do that. Okay. Well, last news story here. Mm. William Shatner's TV show.
Yeah.
Has been canceled, apparently, by CBS.
And this is really disappointing to me. I really enjoyed the show, which is amazing because it's a show based on a Twitter feed, and it's a show starring an 80-year-old William Shatner, which... Yeah. I don't know about you, but when I'm 80, I'm not planning on starring in a sitcom. I'm planning on, you know, relaxing on a beach somewhere. But these Star Trek actors, Leonard Nimoy has been on Fringe, even though he's pushing 80 as well.
Yeah.
And he's in that new Bruno Mars music video. It's amazing that these guys are hanging on and still doing stuff. Did you watch Bleep My Dad Says?
No, I have. I've never seen it. I know of it, and of course I know of the Twitter feed. Mm. Never had a chance to see the actual show, though. And I haven't seen the Bruno Mars video either. Is it up on YouTube?
It is up on YouTube. Okay. We'll make sure we have that.
Yeah, let's put a link to that in so everyone can go see it.
It's Leonard Nimoy at his funniest, I believe.
Now, you've heard of The Wrath of Khan, but have you heard of The Khan of Wrath? Today, we're joined by Star Trek author and historian Larry Nemechek to tell us about the 1982 fan convention known as Ultimate Fantasy. Welcome to the Ready Room, Larry.
Well, it's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
So, Ultimate Fantasy, 1982 in Houston. This is the event that has come to be known as the Khan of Wrath, right?
Right, right. That's what they called it. And just context, and for everybody that doesn't go back that far, Star Trek was in the 60s, and the first movie was motion picture was 79. Wrath of Khan came out in 82. And the first big, huge New York City Star Trek convention started in 73, and they were kind of major icons and became huge. And by the late 70s, there were conventions all over the place, and some of them were flops, and some of them were fans that, you know, their reach exceeded their grasp. And some of them were, you know, a lot of people got started in the 70s, Creation Conventions and Vulcan and lots of people that were professionals and fans both. But no one had ever done a humongously big attempt to try to put the whole cast on stage together at one time. They tried it once before. Convention did, Walter corrected me, and he was the only one not there because of a prior commitment. But a group in Houston had been doing conventions, and they were talking to Walter and George one year when they were guesting about doing that kind of thing, only not just having it be a convention with Q&A and signing, but having it basically be a rock concert and having an orchestra and a laser show and a playlet reading. And, you know, and some of these things have been done since, but this was 1982 and conventions had been around 6, 7, 8 years, but nobody had gone this direction. So they actually called it the Ultimate Fantasy because the whole cast would be together and it'd be this huge show. And it was attached to the regular Houston Con convention that had been going several years. It was local. In fact, that was at the Shamrock Hilton and Convention Center and Hotel. And this was going to be the NBA, the basketball, professional basketball arena, rock concert arena at the time in Houston, the Summit. And they had rented that for not just one, but three shows, two on Saturday, one on Sunday, because they thought this was going to be so cool. 17,000 seat arena would sell out three times in one weekend when everyone came into town for it. And the ultimate fantasy was for the outer circle of organizers, for the fans, for the dealers, and for the LA people, the cast, and all the cast came except for Leonard Nimoy. And he even tried to come at the last minute, and they turned him away. But the whole cast, including...
They turned him away. They turned away Nimoy.
Right, right.
I see.
Because it was, I know it's, I don't know if they were being, somebody that knew something was being, humanistic or, or they just said they were being silly and said, oh, the programs are printed and the schedule's printed. But including Merritt Buttrick and Kirstie Alley and Harve Bennett, the producer.
Wow.
And an extra one of the extras, one of the women that was sat at the helm on the Reliant mm-hmm. of Khan's crew, a woman named Laura Banks. Everyone showed up on Friday to this thing of not thousands of people, but hundreds.
Wow.
And enough, though, where the Shamrock Hilton was turning people out of their rooms or not letting them check in. A sea of fans sitting on their luggage because the things they thought they had paid for, the hotel never got the money for.
Okay, so the hotel was turning wow. these people away, not because they didn't have rooms, but because the fans, the con organizers were supposed to have paid the hotel for the rooms.
Right, they were supposed to have had a package. Okay. People were paying package rates, and again, they had there were over a dozen people on the committee on the on both the convention and the special show at the Ultimate Fantasy show that was out at the Summit Arena. Just the tiny little inner circle of 1, 2, 3 people had any idea that it was going down like this. And so what you had happen was every circle of people in their own way, the fans, the dealers, the organizers, the organizing crew, and the cast, the Hollywood celebs from L.A., everybody in their own way decided that it was the best thing to do was to go ahead and make this thing happen. The LA people especially thought that, they can't have, they had nothing to do with this, but if they left, it would all the mud would fall on them. And here's Star Trek and Wrath of Khan had just come out and kind of rejuvenated the franchise. And the last thing they wanted was for Star Trek and Paramount to be, wrung through the mud. So Harve jumped in and kind of played Papa producer and calmed everybody down and said, let's go. And remember, they did not just one, but 3 shows over the weekend, not to thousands of people, but to a few hundred in this cavernous arena.
A few hundred. I'm curious if you can give some background on, like you said, this is coming right off of Wrath of Khan. And the fans, I would think the fan base is obviously hungry to see the actors. What happened that caused only hundreds of people to come out to an event where you had the entire cast together?
Well, don't know if it was the fact that it was Houston, the fact that it was summer. I mean, that's one of the things I want to get into when I talk to the inner circle of people. The other thing was this had tied in with Starlog magazine, mm-hmm. which, in the pre-internet yep. days, and before it kind of jumped the shark and became more of a PR fluff yeah. magazine. The first few years, it was the big thing that united fandom, sci-fi fandom. And the Ultimate Fantasy had run 2 or 3 full-page ads, and Kerry O'Quinn, who was the co-publisher then, was going to be the master of ceremonies. So there was another, imprimatur that was another nice endorsement, and people were looking forward to that. So what finally happened in the end? I don't know if it was just too much for a lot of people still at that time.
What was the cost of the convention for the package, for admission, for hotel that they were selling?
Yeah. Now, the thing is, I went down to – this was my first big road trip just as a young guy right mm-hmm. out of college. So I was actually there with a couple of my buddies and my brother. So I had it from that end. But it was the Ultimate Fantasy was an add-on extra, Ticketmaster type production on top of the regular convention, but you could pay a big package and go to that. And again, I haven't got back with the exact numbers, but I do have my ticket just from the summit alone, from the Wrath of Khan alone. And, you could pay upwards from $20 to $70 for your ticket in the arena, and this was in 82. So that was comparable to what a regular A-rated, rock concert would draw as far as a ticket price.
Okay. So it wasn't an extravagant yeah. amount of money.
Well, it was, if you're talking about blue-collar people or young fans, yeah. or teens and 20s, this is 1982 dollars, that was a lot. I mean, I'm looking at the ticket and the parking fee was 65 cents. So,
Well, yeah.
Inflate that for inflation and then you know.
Yeah, but you still would think that more people would turn out for an event like this, especially because you said the Houston Con itself, this wasn't the first year that some of it was going on.
Right, and of course the regional and local fans were coming to that, but the whole point of the Ultimate Fantasy was that people came from around, and they did come in from around the country. In fact, that's why so many people were still there as it was melting down on Friday. The locals, I think, were all scared away, and the local media descended on this. One of the things that Harv Bennett did as kind of in a producerly role even here was call around some of the local stations or from the networks down and say, hey, don't spin this against us. We didn't have anything to do with it. In fact, we're hanging on and we're going to make the show go. So, but, you know, everybody in their own way. And the whole reason this kind of imploded in my face, or I shouldn't say imploded. The whole reason the light bulb went over my head was I was at a back home at my old hometown convention, CinderCon, and at the Dead Dog party afterwards, I heard a guy talking across the room about Ultimate Fantasy in Houston and crazy things. And I walked over and I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't thought about this in years. And he was the tech. It was a guy named Bill Parker, the tech director on the stage part. I had revolving stage, the Delta Shield or the Arrowhead shaped stage. And they had a talk show format for part of the show. And they, you know, it was supposed to be a laser light show and the orchestra and a playlet. And Walter Koenig was going to write a one act play and they were going to perform it. And all of that ultimately happened, although the orchestra balked at not having their pay in escrow, so they kind of became a begged upon 6-7-8 piece combo.
Someone that descended the music arrangements did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can relate to that. I used to be an orchestra member. I can relate to that. But, and I guess it was not an orchestra made up of entirely of Star Trek fans who would do it for free just to be part of the con. So.
No, I think this was legit. Yeah. No, this wasn't like McDonald's All Star Marching Band or anything. It was a legit group. So anyway, so. I heard him talking stories and my mind went, oh my God, this is hysterical. And he was telling enough stories that I thought this is a project that I should just jump in and do and interview people. And then I thought, no, we need to do more than interview them, you know, on print. We need to get this on camera. And then I thought, ding, if this holds together the way I think it might, we might have a real documentary here. So,
okay, so then you went to Harv Bennett, and I know Harv and Walter Koenig are involved with you right now on this project, right?
Well, they've been interviewed.
Okay.
And we're working our way down the list for more people. So, but we're also going to have all the people in Houston who most all of them are still there. One or two have passed away. One guy's in Seattle. We're going to get him. But we're working on that, and we're going to set up a thing where fans around the country, rather than us blow a humongous travel budget, we're going to have a thing where if you were there and have a great story, can submit something. I have to roll out the specifics on this, but we're going to have it set up on our site and describe it so that you can submit a video and maybe have it included in the movie.
Okay. All right. So
personal first person type memory. Yeah.
So that leads me to the things that you're looking for are, I think you called them survivors of the Con of Wrath, right?
Well, I could just see everybody having I survived the Con of Wrath, you know, t-shirt. Kind of.
And you're looking for their memories of the event, their photos, video, if they have any, of what took place.
Yes. I keep forgetting to mention. I, a lot of people have clips in it, you know, and home cameras weren't huge in '82, but the more AV minded probably had.
Well, no, they were literally huge.
Right. Not the thing you wanted to stick in your suitcase to fly with, even in pre-9/11 days.
That's right.
But we're looking down. We think we have a good line on some contemporary footage from the crew in Houston. So we're fingers crossed that turns out, because we do need some visuals, and we're going to go back to the scene, the venues, with some modern day memory telling by the ones that were working on it. But we're just almost hoping that we'll have some good contemporary footage. So yeah, we're looking for personal memories from people that were there, especially if they have a great story or brush with greatness or something. And also to help start up our funding. And when this is a low budget, I say a small budget. I don't mean low budget as in cheap, but it's very producible. That was one of the reasons I wanted to jump in and do this as my first production. And I've been looking to do something or be a part of something for several years. And I've done some small projects, but not just to be a word guy, but have the moving picture added as well. And like I said, the talking to Bill that day, the light bulb just went over my head. And after checking on a few things then and a few months over the next few months and telling people about this and not even pitching it to them to do so, but having people, two friends especially, jump on as editor and as the cameraman, who don't even care if we get into money. They just want to do it because they think it's a great story. As I keep saying, it's like a riches to rags to riches story. From meltdown to miracle. So because people have said, oh, I've been to cons that flopped and I've been to things. Yeah, but
not like
they
this.
Weren't this huge. Yeah, not like this. And not to where people jumped in and kept it going on this big a scale. And also we've got kind of our retro cool sentimentality about that time period. So that adds to it too. But we're asking on the site, we have a place where people can make small donations in return for some freebies and tchotchkes. Everybody would have a screen credit, you know, and then we'd go work through. I've got to do the exact detail in the next week or two, but like mugs and t-shirts and copies of the DVD and some posters and signed pictures, all the way up to if it's 1,000 or 2,500. Now we'll throw the kitchen sink in for that, but
that would be the kitchen sink from Neelix's kitchen, right?
Right.
Okay.
The crossing generations there, but yeah, right. Yeah. Chef's galley kitchen.
The chef's galley kitchen. All right. So you're taking, you're asking for donations, really in any amount, right? So from as low as say $10 up into whatever.
Right. I mean, and I don't mean to sound facetious. I'm really kind of putting my name and my reputation. I mean, I've been a Trek fan all my life, but if you go to my site at LarryNemechek.com, or if you read The Communicator, or you've read my Next Generation Companion, the official guide for Next Generation, or seen any of the things my columns in the Trek magazine right now that I've been with them for 10, 12 years.
And here in Japan, we even have your Star Trek Trek files in Japanese in the book.
That's right. You guys are the only one. Yep. See, the whole world has no clue what I've been doing the last 4 years.
You're everywhere, Larry. You're everywhere.
Well, the world doesn't know it sometimes because the fact files went for 6 years around the world, everywhere but in the States. But yes, you all have the DVDs, which are coming to a close or have closed, and we're about to launch. Maybe I shouldn't say anything. There's another Japan project coming up.
Secret great. Japan project.
That's really, to the rest of the world, is really wacky, but I guess it makes sense in Japanese marketing. But
okay, we'll let you know when it comes out. Okay, so again, it's your website at LarryNemechek.com.
Right.
For more information.
And yeah, and my blog, the Trekland blog, and people have been there. I have at least 30 or 40 videos by now. They're YouTube hosted, but they're on my blog. I'd love for people to comment to there instead of on YouTube. But I have interviews with Marina Sirtis and Ethan Phillips and Bob Picardo. And when people are doing another project, like Armin Sherman and Kitty Swink, his wife, were just in a play in L.A. And even if you can't see the play, it's nice to see them talk. I have a ton of things like that there, and also some fan pieces. That's my blog, Trekland, and treklandblog.com, or you can get there from the website. But we got Facebook, too, and I'm on Twitter at Larry Nemechek. But I have my Larry Nemechek's Trekland page, and we do have a Con of Wrath webpage, conofwrath.com, and a Con of Wrath Facebook page, so... Of course. So likes and, you know, joins and whatever are always nice. If anybody wants to go like the Facebook page, that would be great.
All right. Well, this sounds like an exciting project, Larry. And I understand you're hoping to premiere this by the 30th anniversary, which is next year, of Ultimate Fantasy.
Yeah, we don't have anything hard and fast, but that's kind of where that's a doable goal. It depends on how fast things come together with Houston. Again, we're doing this low budget. We're doing this on the side of other things we have going at the same time, both myself and my editor and cameraman. But we think we can map it out to where we can do this by next summer, and it'll be a big year. Whether JJ's movie comes out in June or later on, as is starting to look apparent, it'll be a big Star Trek year next year. And didn't even plan on that, but hopefully we'll feed into that. And the guys themselves in Houston have reunions every so often, and I think this has stirred them up into having a 30th anniversary reunion. So it's all fun, and I'm just very big about preserving our fandom history before the first generation or two are all gone and we lose our roots that way. I used to do that in the communicator and interview the first generation of fans. So I'd like to add to that too. But I also hope this transcends just the Trek circuit. And if we can get into some human nature and some humanity here, that's a goal of mine too. So we'll see how that goes.
Great. Well, it sounds exciting. I can't wait to see it when it comes out. And I encourage everybody, go to LarryNemechek.com, go to Trekland, and learn more and help Larry make this documentary a reality.
And people can also, you know, I'll be at Comic-Con San Diego and Vegas Trek in Las Vegas. Come up and say hi, and we'll be doing some, you know, we'll be all over the place there as usual, especially in Vegas. So you'll have some visitors there. And I have a little acting thing, divine-white.com. I keep trying to remember to, I'm a guest star in this very funny British droll web series that's on.
Oh, really?
And there's six webisodes that are about 5 to 10 minutes each, and the season finale just went up today. And but if you go to divine-white.com, you can see it there, and it's very I'm one of two Yanks in amongst the Brits. So
okay, well, I'm heading there right after this.
Okay.
Well, Larry, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us here on your nighttime there.
Well, Christopher, thanks for having me on. I'm great to, glad you've got this going. And we've been tweeting back and forth, but it's great to be on. And, of course, we're almost only a couple more months till college football season. So.
Yes, and we'll have plenty to talk about then.
Boomer Sooner.
Okay, and Roll Tide. All right, thanks so much, Larry. You have a good night there.
Okay, good. Oh,
yeah, thanks, Larry.
All right.
Yeah, bye. Thanks.
So let's move into our future topic today, Greg, which is new Trek on TV.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us fans, we really want to have a new Star Trek series on TV. I'm not sure if we're going to get one anytime soon, but there's been a few kind of false starts over Trek history, and there's actually been a few things proposed here over the past few years that haven't really gotten a lot of noise amongst fans, I think. So why don't we, before we get into what we might get next time, why don't we go back and look at what happened after TOS?
Right.
Before we had Next Generation, and even before we had the Star Trek the Motion Picture in the theaters.
Right. Now, the original series was syndicated, is that correct? Just like Next Gen was.
The original series actually on NBC.
Was it just an NBC, straight NBC show?
It was produced by Desilu Studios, and it was on NBC, if I remember correctly.
Okay, so, and then after two seasons, they wanted to cancel it, and then there was sort of a letter-writing campaign, and it managed to get a third season just barely, but then they went ahead and let it drop after that. And Star Trek wasn't really a big deal at that point, from what I understand.
Even the third season, I think they suffered a lot. I think their funding was cut a good bit. Roddenberry was not really there, I think, as much because of disputes with the studio and so forth. But
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then basically there was 10 years. Is that right? About maybe six or
was
7 years.
69.
69 was the last part.
Until 79. Motion picture was in 79.
79, right. So basically what happened was Star Wars happened. And it was this huge space spectacle. And everyone said, oh, what do we have that's space? And there was a space-themed James Bond movie that got made really fast. And Paramount said, oh, well, we've got this Star Trek thing that people seem to like. Let's make a new one of those.
Star Trek thing. Which sounds funny to us now, but right. I guess back then it kind of was just this thing.
Especially in the days before DVD or the internet. Was just this show that was on, you know, in the 60s, and who cares about that anymore?
And got canceled. Yeah.
So yeah, why don't you talk for a second about Phase Two then?
Well, okay. So I'm sure most fans have heard of Phase Two. It's pretty widely known that there was a series that was in development in the 70s called Phase Two, and this was, like you said, after the success of Star Wars, there was kind of this resurgence of let's try to get some sci-fi stuff out there. And Paramount had Star Trek.
Right.
So in 1977, they began working on, well, this we actually talked about last week too, when they launched Voyager. Paramount launched UPN, and Voyager was the flagship show that was developed for UPN. And this is a very similar situation. You know, I mentioned last week that Paramount had tried to start their own TV network a few times in the past, and it had never happened. And then finally with Voyager, it did. Well, if you go back to the 70s, in 77, Paramount was trying to launch a new television network. And the plans that they had drawn up were that they would launch this new TV network and the flagship program would be Star Trek. And this was the show that was going to be called Phase Two. And the premise of Phase Two was that it would be the second five-year mission of the original Enterprise 1701 under the command of Captain Kirk.
Right.
And they actually, this got further along than maybe some fans realized. They actually started constructing sets in July of 77. And they put out a writer's and director's guide in August of 77. And they were planning to premiere this show in 78, in the spring of 1978.
And they got most of the cast back, from what
I understand. Yeah, they did. In fact, they got everyone, I believe, except for Leonard Nimoy. You would have had Kirk, McCoy, Uhura, Scotty, Chekhov, Sulu. You would even have Nurse Chapel and Yeoman Rand back.
Right. Amazingly.
But no Spock.
Right. And in his place, we had this guy, Zahn.
Zahn.
Who I've seen. He actually looks pretty good. He would have made a good Vulcan, I think.
Well, yeah, there are images of him because they were far enough along in the development of this program. There are images of Zahn. Yeah.
So there were several scripts written, I believe, as well.
Yes, there were quite a few scripts, at least basic script concepts created. And if you go to Memory Alpha and you look up Phase 2, you can see some of these images of Zahn, for example. And he was going to be a Vulcan science officer, played by David Guttrow.
Right. Very much just Spock, but we don't have Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, kind of like that. Like everyone loves Spock, but Leonard's not going to do it, so we got to have a Vulcan in his place.
Yeah.
And there were two characters that everyone knows that were going to be new regular crew members on Phase Two, and that was Decker and Ilea, who were two of the main characters in the motion picture.
Right. Now Decker would have been the first officer. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Which there was supposed to be a first officer on the original series, and then it was a woman, and the network said, don't do that.
Right. In the cage, we had Majel Barrett playing Number One. I don't think she ever had a name, right? She was just called Number One.
And so she sort
and
of
then
got...
she was nixed.
They dropped her and never really... I guess Spock was supposed to be science officer and first officer, but it never really made sense.
I've always thought of Spock as a first officer, but, you know, I don't think that position was actually there. But you do think of him, I guess, because as you go through the movies as well, you know, he's also a captain in rank, and so you do kind of feel Kirk and Spock are like the captain and the first officer, even if that's not officially.
But Decker's much like Riker eventually became, sort of this young first officer, more gung-ho than
Yeah. So, like you said, there were a few scripts that were mm-hmm. prepared, and the pilot episode was going to be called In Thy Image.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story that eventually, when the series kind of got scrapped and they decided to go big screen, that's the story that was the foundation, anyway, for the motion picture.
Yeah. And I really think it might have worked as a, you know, 40-minute, maybe, you know, 2-hour pilot idea as just a TV show. You know,
yeah.
It mostly takes place on the bridge, which is fine because it's a TV show and that's one of their main sets. And it could have a few spectacular shots that they could do fairly cheaply as a pilot episode. And it could have worked quite well.
Yeah, it could. And one problem with the motion picture, I think, there was so much screen time was spent on nostalgic things,
mm-hmm.
like the never-ending flyby of the Enterprise, and, you know, things like that,
yeah.
which you wouldn't have had in a pilot episode for a TV series. So you could have gotten more to the core of that story.
Right.
But that story went through all sorts of turmoil and evolution.
Right.
And if you haven't read it, I encourage everyone to read or listen to the audiobook from William Shatner called Star Trek Movie Memories.
Hmm.
You get a lot of background of what happened going into the motion picture. There are actually two books. There's one called Star Trek Memories,
mm-hmm.
and then there's Star Trek Movie Memories. Both really interested. If you get the audiobooks, they're, you can get them on audible.com and probably in iTunes as well, but they're actually narrated by William Shatner.
Oh, wow.
So it's like you're really hearing it firsthand from him.
I will definitely have to listen to that after this.
It's really good, and there's a lot of this Phase 2 information mixed in those two books, so very good things there.
Okay.
And one more point here on Phase 2 about the scripts is some people may not realize that there are a couple of TNG episodes that were Phase 2 scripts.
Right.
The Child is one, mm-hmm. where Deanna has this alien energy entity come into her, and she gives birth. And the other is one of my favorite Star Trek The Next Generation episodes, which is Devil's Due, which is kind of a goofy episode, but I don't know why I like that episode. There's just something about that episode that I enjoy.
Mm.
That was also a Phase 2 script.
Yeah. Yeah, they were sort of floundering, I feel like, in the writer's room on Next Gen, saying, you know, what are we going to do?
Well, I think they were. You know, you hear, not to get off on a TNG tangent here too much, but if you listen to the creators, especially in the extras on the DVD box sets for TNG, they were kind of flying by the seats of their pants a lot in the early seasons of TNG, trying to churn out 26 scripts.
Yeah.
Every season and get all that stuff produced.
Right.
And so I think they did kind of dip into the Phase 2 bucket there a little bit.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think? If they had managed to make a Star Trek series in the 70s, would it have had the same effect that motion picture eventually had? Or I guess Star Trek 2 more so, but in reinvigorating the fan base?
That's a good question. You know, I don't know. I think that replacing Spock with Zahn would, of course, I'm looking through this through the eyes, you know, of a fan 40 years later, but I think that replacing Spock may have been a big mistake. I think that you might have had a lot, because Spock was probably the most popular character on TOS.
Yep.
And I think that a lot of fans would have been so disappointed that there was no Spock, that you might have got kind of that Enterprise effect that we talked about last week, where after Voyager, fans just didn't buy into Enterprise. TOS, a new Star Trek series coming on less than 10 years after TOS, and the most popular character not being there, but everyone else is there. I'm not sure that fans would have bought into that. And if fans didn't buy into that, we may not have had that momentum that led us into TNG and to everything else that we have had since then.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So I'm sort of happy Phase 2 didn't happen, even though I'd love to see more Star Trek episodes with the Enterprise crew.
Yeah, but I don't know if it would have had the same feeling.
That's true.
We might have gotten more episodes with the same crew, but it could have been a totally different show.
Hmm.
So I don't know. I'm glad that they worked on developing it, and to the point where we have all this interesting material. Like there's a hardcover, I think it's hardcover, Phase 2 book that tells about the history of the series and has lots of artwork, concepts and so forth in there. I love that we have all that stuff. I'm probably glad that we didn't actually have the series, though.
Interesting.
So, let's move on from phase two, and let's get into a couple of other more recent things that I think fans might find interesting.
Well, from, 1987 until 2005, we always had Star Trek on the air.
Yes.
Which is pretty astonishing, considering that was my entire life up till
amazing.
That point.
And I think that kind of... I think that contributes a little bit to the decline of the franchise that we experienced in 2000, well, the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Because really, I mean, it kind of started with Insurrection, then Nemesis, I guess, and then Enterprise. It was all kind of a decline of Star Trek that was going on. And I think people got really spoiled by the fact that we had new Star Trek on every week for 18 years, 18 consecutive years, I believe it was. From The Next Generation, 87, until the end of Voyager. Mm-hmm. Which, speaking of the end of Voyager, I think last week I may have mentioned 99, which was actually the end of Deep Space Nine. Voyager ended, I think, in 2001, right?
2000, yes, I believe 2001 is it.
It was one, I think, right? So for all that time, you know, we had new Star Trek on every single week. Mm-hmm. I think people got really spoiled by that. So now we've had no new Star Trek apart from the JJ movie since 2005. May of 2005 was the end of Enterprise,
but of course there wasn't a clean break. Like, they decided solidly no more Star Trek. They just said, we're not going to make Enterprise anymore, and then they actually took some pitches, it seems, and then we have some information about a few of these pitches.
Yeah, it does seem it seems that way, and it's also interesting to me because not only did Enterprise just kind of end, I mean, we knew it almost got canceled after its third season, and then they got a fourth season, and then it was canceled, and then we didn't know what was going on. And then, if you remember, there were a couple of years. StarTrek.com recently relaunched their website, a renewal of their website. Yeah. And that site itself just kind of languished for several years. Mm-hmm. It was like there was no interest from the studio in Star Trek for a few years. But apparently that may not have been completely true, because we find out that there were a couple of things going on behind the scenes. And one of them is an animated series called Final Frontier. Yeah.
Now, obviously, we skipped over talking about the TAS, as it's referred to, the animated series.
Right. Because that actually was on TV.
It was. I mean, so we actually did have Star Trek after TOS, before the motion picture. I've only seen a couple episodes of it. It's only considered semi-canon, if that. But there was animated Star Trek.
Yeah, there was. And it's, for a long time, it wasn't considered canon. And that might be one reason why we kind of skipped over it. In recent years, there's kind of been an effort made to pull it into canon. You know, Memory Alpha seems to consider it canon because Memory Alpha is supposed to be the wiki for canon Star Trek.
Right.
But not only them, but CBS as well. You know, they put out the box set in, I want to say it was 2008. I don't remember for certain if it was 07, 08. They put out a box set for TAS. Mm-hmm. And there has been more of an effort, and StarTrek.com itself includes TAS as a series, which kind of makes it canon because they don't include the fan series or things like that.
Well, perhaps I should go back and actually watch it, and then we can have a good feature discussion of
Yeah, we should do that, because I have the set, and I've watched a number of them. But I haven't watched it as extensively as I have the live-action series.
But where that was extremely low-budget animation, this show, which we should say was called Final Frontier, would have been a higher-budget animated show, which I believe we have a link to some of the concept art.
Yeah, we'll put a link in there with some of the concept art. And so to give you the premise of what this was, the reports are that this was an animated series that began development just after the cancellation of Enterprise in May 2005. And reportedly, CBS actually showed interest in producing this series. So it wasn't just something that some fans had a concept of and started doing artwork. But apparently there was enough interest from CBS that the people doing it, they actually formed a studio called Zero Room, which is still around. And their mission was to develop this series. And they were asked, they say they were asked to develop artwork and to write 5 scripts for mini episodes. And the premise of this series is that it would have been set in the year 2528. So it puts us in the 26th century. And it would have been a darker future. Which is a theme that we'll talk about even more as we go on here, which seems to be a common thread in some of these concepts for the future direction of Star Trek series. There are a few interesting things in here. The premise of this is that the Federation and the Romulans would have fought a war that ended in the 2460s. And this war was to have been started by some unknown instigator using an Omega particle weapon. And this caused a large portion of the galaxy to become impassable for starships. And so the Federation is split into two.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
So you have the Federation, two halves unable to really interact with each other anymore. And then as a additional element, you had Kronos, the Klingon homeworld, being occupied by the Romulans. You had Andoria destroyed, as opposed to Vulcan being destroyed in the J.J. Abrams film. And Vulcan has left the Federation at this point because they're in the reunification talks with Romulus still, I believe. And we would have had a new Enterprise, which would have been a Bismarck-class vessel commanded by Captain Alexander Chase. So how does this sound to you? I mean, is this something that you as a fan would be interested in seeing?
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I wouldn't typically think that I would like an animated series, except that Star Wars has been doing animated shows recently, and it started in 2003 with this 2D animated show, Clone Wars, and then recently they've made the 3D animated show, The Clone Wars, in 2008. And both of these have been really fantastic, especially the 2D animated one was very stylish, and it didn't feel like a kiddie show. It felt like a real continuation of Star Wars, but without having, you know, get this huge production together and, you know, hire real actors and put them in costumes and do blue screens and take 3 years to do it. You can actually just have it coming out every week. And so as a way to do a lower budget Star Trek, but keep something Star Trek on the air, I really like the idea.
Do you think the general fan base would buy into an animated Star Trek the way that they buy into a live action Star Trek?
Well, I think it's good that we're taking some time off from Star Trek. I think if this had come out in 2006, it might have had a hard time finding its footing. But a show like this today, especially if it could be on the web or over Netflix or iTunes, I think people could accept it. They'd have to see. They'd have to make a few of these mini episodes and see what people think of it. But I think they really could be successful.
And is this a series that you could see being treated like a live-action Star Trek, where we had 26 episodes per season for 7 seasons and really tell a full story?
Yeah. I kind of feel like we've moved on from doing that sort
from
of show.
That. Yeah.
That all these shows were shot in a very specific style and done in a specific way from Next Gen up through Enterprise. Enterprise was a slight change from it, but still pretty much produced the same way.
Yeah,
and I feel like this would be a real break. And maybe you'd do 2 years of this and then try a different concept afterwards. But it would have to be very far in the future, like this is.
Well, this kind of reminds me here. Tell me what you think about this. So have you watched the 4400?
I've seen portions of it.
Okay. The 4400 is done... I think it was a USA Network show. I watch it on DVD over here, but I think it was on USA Network. But it was one of those shows that's done in the summertime in the US now.
Right.
Instead of everything being reruns, you have these shorter programs that come on only in the summer. And there were like, I want to say there were like, the first season, it was really short. It was like 6 episodes, something like that. And then the later seasons, I think they did 12 or so episodes per season. And it went for 3 seasons, I believe. Do you think that could be the future of Star Trek, to have that type of more compact storytelling?
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the summer, but just have fewer seasons and fewer episodes per season. Not a TV miniseries, but not that very epic 7-season series that we've had in the past.
I really think you're on the right track there. That what they need to do is create a very focused, as you say, like shorter idea for a show, and have it come out every week rather than this spread out thing. It's just, sci-fi is a very hard thing to make work on TV. And I think the more it's focused, the more successful it's going to be.
Okay. Interesting. So, yeah, for me, I think I could get into a series like this, that's animated. I'm not sure if it would have the same appeal for me as a live action show, though. I'm not sure how I feel about it yet. I think it could be an interesting addition to the Star Trek franchise to do something like this. And I like the idea of having kind of a darker future, especially if you're doing it animated like this, I think would work. Because we do need to take Star Trek, and we can't just come back and do another TNG or another Voyager.
It's got to be. Got to move past there.
So while we're talking about the darker future, let's go to the next series that we've heard about just recently, is called Federation.
Yeah.
And I saw the logo for it, which I think Mike Okuda did. It was interesting to me that it was basically the logo from the old Judith and Garfield Reeve Stevens novel from the early 90s called Federation. But the premise of this has really nothing to do with the novel. The premise of this one, first of all, this is a series that was proposed by Bryan Singer in 2006. That's the report that's come out. And I think originally I saw this reported as being something that was pitched to the studio and declined. And did I see recently, was Jonathan Frakes' name attached to this in some way?
I believe what I saw was that Jonathan Frakes also pitched a show.
Oh, he also
unrelated to this one.
Unrelated to this one. I believe. I remembered seeing his name and this, and then I was thinking that it was not reported accurately, is what I had heard.
I'm still waiting to get details on what the Frakes show was.
Yeah, I don't know what that one was, the details on that. So this one was from Bryan Singer, and apparently this was proposed in 2006, and there was a 25-page proposal that was written by Robert Meyer Burnett and Jeffrey Thorne. And it included the details of 8 primary characters and outlines for the first 4 episodes.
And this one was going to be set even further in the future than Final Frontier would have been.
So when is this one set?
So this one was the year 3000.
Which we've seen before, briefly, on Enterprise, right?
Yeah, like we've seen this far future a couple times, at least referenced in Voyager. They did it some too with these temporal agents.
Yeah.
We're all supposed to be from this area, which is why it kind of worries me. I don't know that we need a Star Trek show set with where time travel's just sort of taken for granted.
Yeah, I don't know if would this we'll talk about the premise here. I'm not sure that this premise.
So this premise wouldn't have involved time travel.
Right,
but I think
it would not have involved time travel.
I think chronologically it would have, but they would sort of say, well, that hasn't happened yet. But I think
would end up with many, many centuries of unwritten Star Trek history.
We would.
You might be able to go back and explore in the future in yet another TV series, but you would also get into the situation of continuity problems that you had to deal with between Enterprise and TOS.
And I understand the wanting to put it so far forward, because you can reinvent everything.
Yeah.
And I think the idea is we really want to get as far away from Gene Roddenberry as we can, because what they talk about is showing the death of Utopia and actually showing the Federation falling apart.
Mm-hmm. So this is a time, this is in the 30, heading into the 31st mm-hmm. century. And this is a time where it's an age of decline for the Federation mm-hmm. and kind of a rebirth of the Federation mm-hmm. that we're talking about here. Well, here's a few points mm-hmm. That are being that were part of this idea. Mm-hmm. This one I find really odd. The Ferengi have become the dominant power yeah. in the galaxy. Can you buy into that?
I can't.
I can't buy into that either. I haven't seen anything on Star Trek to suggest to me that the Ferengi could ever become yeah. the dominant power in the galaxy. So that right there is a little bit tough for me to swallow in this concept. Mm-hmm. Now, the Vulcans and Romulans have reunified. That one, I can buy into that.
Sure. I mean, that Spock was moving towards that. And yeah. Even now we have in the new movie, Romulus has been destroyed, so that might even focus them even harder on reunification. I could see that happening.
Yeah. Then another idea here was that the Cardassians and the Klingons have become mystical cultures that are less warlike.
Yeah. So
we're
like,
talking about how many centuries are we talking here? From 24th century
yeah.
up to the 31st century. So we're talking
700 years.
I mean, it's possible, I guess. I mean, the Klingon, we see them warlike in space, in mm-hmm. their ships. They're going out, they're warriors. But when we do see their home world, there's somewhat of a mystical
yeah.
nature to it.
Part of my problem with this pitch is that it's so far in the future
yeah.
that, I mean, why would the Klingons and the Cardassians even be around anymore? You know?
Yeah.
All these people, you know, warp travel will be so easy. You know, we'll just do warp 10 and all these planets will basically be right next to each other. They'll be, you know, intermarrying. I don't think any of these species particularities will exist that much by the time we get to the year 3000.
You know, so you think there would be more mixing of the genes of species
yeah,
the way that we're starting to have now on Earth?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
in our current culture where
oh, yeah.
everyone is more, it's easier to hop on a plane and, yeah. and you meet people and you have couples from all around. So
yeah.
interesting. I like the idea of this pitch in terms of it being a decline of the Federation and a rebirth of the Federation. Mm-hmm. I like that for a couple of reasons. I like it because it gives you something new to write.
That's true.
And I also think it's something that the storylines would be something that it's easier for the general audience to associate with mm-hmm. because it would be more realistic. You wouldn't have this perfect human future that Gene Roddenberry envisioned,
yeah, right.
which is admirable, but it's probably not likely to follow that path
right.
just because of human nature. And I also like this because it's... I'd like to see the story. We talked about this last week also in Insurrection a little bit. I'd like mm-hmm. to see the story of how the Federation ages and what happens to it
yeah.
as it declines, and then how the lessons learned along the way shape
right.
a new Federation. Because we
right.
know from Earth, I mean, every great empire, every great civilization eventually falls, mm-hmm. and something new grows out of that.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to see how this perfect future that was kind of created,
right.
which we started seeing go corrupt through Deep Space Nine
right.
and onward. What happens to that down yeah. the road?
I just feel like you don't need to jump to 3000 for that to happen.
Yeah. Where would you put this series?
Right.
On a timeline, where would you put it?
If I were to do a show like this, I think it could be set maybe 10 years after. Okay, so if you look at the new Star Trek movie, it had events that we sort of saw that happened with Romulus being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 10 years after that point, and I think the idea would be to have a galactic war going on right now. You know, Klingons versus Romulans versus Cardassians versus the Federation, and really show the Federation straining at the edges. You know, sort of mm-hmm. do the Dominion War show that we never were able to do before.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have it be Alpha Quadrant people battling it out. And this,
do you want to see the war on the show, or you want to see the aftermath of the war?
Well, this is the thing. I would probably do season one or two be the war, like really mm-hmm. show the war, and then move into the aftermath of the war. I think that would be a really good direction. Maybe do like a five Like I've been really enjoying these like 5-season sci-fi shows where it's all mapped out.
Yeah.
And so show what happens during a war, show what happens after the war, but don't be like DS9 where it was sort of held in that one corner of the galaxy. Go ahead and show the whole thing and really show the Federation like you haven't been able to on any of these shows. But so yeah, that could be the early 25th century, mid 25th century.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. For me, that timeline might be a little bit too soon, but I do agree that we don't need to jump to the year 3000 in order to do this stuff. But I'm probably pretty close to you on that. I might push it out a little further than that. But one thing, actually, this leads us right into the next thing I want to hit here. But before I do that, one other point here was that this series talked about using CG environments on parts of the ship. And that is something that I just wanted to mention that's in the series idea, because I'm going to mention it when we get down here in a minute. We're going to talk about a few other possible directions that haven't been mentioned, but just some ideas. And that plays in there. But now this early 25th century timeline that you just mentioned here, the one thing about that is that Star Trek Online, which of course is not a TV series, and it's not going to be a TV series, I don't think. They mapped out the backstory to Star Trek Online to try to explain what's happening in the game.
Yeah.
And Cryptic is working in conjunction with CBS on Star Trek Online. So there's a possibility that Star Trek Online, some parts of the backstory, some parts of the game, I think could influence a future Star Trek TV series and future direction of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And one thing here is their backstory picks up right after Nemesis, I believe, because it starts out with the internal problems of the Romulan Empire. And it plays out over the course of the years up to 2409, which the start of the 25th century.
Right.
And in this storyline, they explain all these different events that happen. And there is quite a bit of war involved there.
Yes, right.
To get us there. And if this were to become considered canon, then maybe the idea has to be pushed out a little bit. Or then again, maybe it doesn't, because some of this does lead into serious problems for the Federation.
Right.
Just a few highlights of the backstory of STO is that the Romulan Empire splits to the Romulan Star Empire and the Imperial Romulan State. There's a threat of civil war. There's some conflict, the Klingons taking advantage of the weakened Romulans. And then the Gorn come into play, which, you know, the Gorn, I think, is a Star Trek fan favorite.
Yeah.
Even though we've never really seen much of them.
We
have the great Gorn appearance in TOS, and then we have the one on Enterprise.
Very briefly.
Very briefly, and then we don't hear much about it. I mean, even on Deep Space Nine, when we had the Breen come in, kind of out of nowhere, because we need someone new, we didn't even have any real Gorn involvement there either, right? But in the Star Trek Online backstory, the Gorn get embroiled in a war with the Klingons. And that eventually leads to the Federation becoming involved in peace talks, trying to mediate between the Gorn and the Klingons. And then ultimately the Federation back into war with the Klingons.
Right.
After all these, you know, centuries of peaceful relations.
Yeah. So this is a good lead-in to a video game, but it also is a pretty good lead-in to a show, I think. I think they've done a pretty faithful job of imagining what would have happened and what would make an interesting backstory for a new show.
So you can believe the on the very high level premise of what's going on to lead up to STO, you can believe in these events, and you could see that leading into the future of Star Trek on television.
Yeah, I think it all sounds pretty good. I like the idea of them being again at war with the Klingons. I like the idea that they're building a transwarp network, because that makes sense. You know, they start to have that technology on Voyager. They start to understand transwarp more. And I like this time jump to 2409.
Because it's not too far into the future. Mm-hmm. It's just things kind of play out what we saw at the end of the TNG timeline with Nemesis, Deep Space Nine. Because the Jem'Hadar come into play here some. Mm-hmm. Got the Dominion a bit. Yeah. They kind of throw everybody in. Actually, I gave you like a really, really in a nutshell thing here.
I think they're trying to throw, you know, the kitchen sink in for the
gameplay
for the
aspect.
Video game aspect. But you know, it works for the show anyway. Yeah. Now, from what I understand, the game isn't doing quite as well as they'd like it to be doing, and which is disappointing to me, because it's sort of the only ongoing Star Trek other than the Abrams movies.
Yeah, I have to delve a little more into that, the health of the game. Mm. I think it's fairly popular. It's when you develop something as rich as what they've done with Star Trek Online, and you can just tell the work that's gone into it, because it's really beautifully done.
Yeah.
Beautiful game. And I think the fact that you have to pay to play is hurting it. You not only have to buy the software for the game, which is a Windows-only application right now.
I saw when I tried to play
it. Which is a problem. you also have to pay a monthly fee to play, which I think it discourages a lot of people who would otherwise play.
Right.
Now, I have heard a lot of talk that they may be shifting that to free to play.
Yeah.
I hope they do, because I think if they shift it to free to play, I think it will really take off.
Yeah.
I think they need to do a few things to make it take off. And that is, make it free to play. I mean, you buy the software, but it's otherwise free to play.
Mm-hmm.
And get it on Mac, I would like to see. But especially if they could try to get it onto consoles.
Yeah, that'd be good too.
If they could get it on PS3 and they could get it on Xbox, I think it could really, really take off. Because it's a great game, but...
Yeah, it seems to be.
It needs some work, but...
Yeah. Well, so what I'd like to see if we want to talk about the future of Star Trek shows, if online STO does go free to play and maybe gains a little bit of popularity, I'd love to see them do a tie-in animated show. And I could really see this happening, where they just make 10-minute episodes similar to the Star Wars 2D animated show that are set in this time period, that just tell some of the story of what's going on in a very interesting, stylized way. I don't think they'll make a live action show, but please go
ahead. Star Trek Online.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But I think, as an animated show, it could work very well. Plus, they've already established the style.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of cool, original concepts in Star Trek Online in terms of character styles, the uniforms,
right.
ships, and everything. It could carry over very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be interested in seeing that. And they have given so much thought to the backstory.
Yeah.
Even though I don't agree with all the details of the backstory, you know, I think they overuse existing characters too much.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I think there's too much convenient coincidences and who does what.
Right.
Which is a common problem, writing backstories like
sure,
this.
Sure,
sure. For such well-known franchises like Star Trek.
Mm.
But the general premise of the events that take place, you know, you also have things like the Bajor enters the Federation in 2393. You have a normalization of relations between Cardassia and Bajor.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Federation forming scientific cooperation with Cardassia.
Yep.
You have all kinds of little things like that that could play into building a rich story as well that would work in an animated thing. And one other tie-in, this was, I believe the contest is actually over at this point, but there was a contest that Cryptic did with CBS and Star Trek Online to have fans submit designs for the next canon Enterprise, the 1701F. And of course, the key here is that this is a canon Enterprise. Whether it would be used in a future show, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think it's meant to be the flagship of Star Trek Online, the 1701F.
Yeah, and the one they picked is—it looks great. It looks like a really good continuation of what the design evolution has been, looking somewhat like the Enterprise E, but yet somewhat like the D.
Yeah, and I think was it like the Oberth class, kind of the dual neck is going on in the design there. We'll put a link to the artwork on here, Yeah. But that was it's interesting that something like a video game, because we've had Star Trek video games over the years on various platforms, but something like this can actually reach a point where they're working together with CBS and it's official, and this is actually being pulled in as canon.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It's very cool. So I'd love to see this be the ship used in a new show that would tie in with Star Trek Online.
It would be cool. So you seem to be really big on the idea of animated Star Trek, I think, as a next step. Maybe it's... Do you see animated as a future of Star Trek, or you see it as a stepping stone to later having a live-action series again?
Well, I don't see them doing a live-action show, mainly because of you have the live-action movies. And I think they don't want to have confusion or even overlap between the two. I'd love to find out in a later episode. There have been some pitches for a show in the alternate universe back in the TOS era. But I don't think that's going to happen just because they want to focus on the movies and not have oversaturation. But yeah, if they went animated, it could have that separation.
Yeah, it could. And that one, I don't think, I couldn't see that because we're basically in an alternate timeline in TOS now with the JJ movies, to then have a Mirror Universe show set in the TOS timeline.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really see that happening live action. Well, okay, so let's say the JJ movies go 3 or 4 movies. Mm-hmm. Over the next decade or so. Mm-hmm. After that, we have no live action movies again.
Yeah.
Do you see live action Star Trek returning to television?
Oh,
Would you want it as a fan?
I do want live action Star Trek. I'm hoping there's a live action Star Wars TV show that's in the works. I'm hoping that happens. But shows like this are really expensive, and the fan support really has to be there. The concept has to be there. The showrunner has to be on point and really be enthusiastic about it. And I don't think Star Trek is quite at that point to really be done on network TV like it ought to be done.
But what if it were done in syndication like TNG and DS9
were,
and the studio can recoup the costs of producing the show by selling it into syndication, or maybe even a new business model comes through things like Netflix down the road.
I'd love to see them do a Netflix show. That would be really fantastic.
But it would have to be, you know, for those of us abroad, it couldn't be exclusively Netflix.
That's true.
So they would have to do it in a way that it's available worldwide, I think, in order to recoup cost as well.
I guess what I'd say is I don't see Star Trek being done as long as network TV is where the money is, even cable TV being where the money is.
Yeah.
Once we can move into the next paradigm of online distribution, then I really see Star Trek happening, because then I can give my, you know, $2 or $3 an episode directly to the studio, and it doesn't have to go through a network or through the cable company.
Yeah.
I think at that point, then Star Trek... the fan base will be able to fund a show. But that might be 10, 15 years off.
Maybe. Or maybe sooner than we think, the way these things evolve. Okay, well, but before we wrap up here on this topic, Abramsverse.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ever see these characters and these actors from the J.J. Abrams movies cross over to television and continue this story as a television series? And would you want to?
I think they could easily. They could film the next movie and then take the sets and just shoot a TV show. I think it's doable. I don't know if the money's there, but I think the cast is good. I think if they hired good writers, there are good sci-fi writers out there. I think it could happen. I don't know if the audience is quite there to tune in week after week.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. I think it could be interesting, but... I don't know if the audience is there, and I don't know if they could get all these actors to commit.
That's the other thing.
To a TV series. I mean, I know Zachary Quinto was on Heroes, but they are becoming more in demand as a result of the 2009 movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to work out schedules for a weekly TV series.
Yeah.
it could be really difficult, and they would demand more and more money.
Yeah, I mean, even trying to put together a Firefly series right now is so difficult because all the actors are doing incredibly different things. These actors in Star Trek want to be doing stuff other than Star Trek. So yeah. to tie all of them down to a TV show would be very difficult.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think a couple real quick, just a couple more ideas that might be out there. Enterprise B movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not movie, Enterprise B TV series.
Yeah.
Any interest in that?
I'd love to see that time period, but it might be a place more for the books to delve into. If we do see an animated show, they could easily do just 10 episodes set in that time period. It's mainly just I want to see that timeline filled in in the canon.
You want to know what happened. You don't necessarily need to have an entire series
right
dedicated to that.
Yeah.
All right. And the last one, Titan. Titan are the novel series
yes.
that's based on Riker's command after he left the Enterprise E
yep.
at the end of Nemesis.
And I believe this is probably the show Jonathan Frakes pitched to CBS.
You think?
As a post-Nemesis Captain Riker and his wife, you know, being probably a counselor on the ship as well.
Yeah.
Very much in the vein of Voyager or Next Gen as just being a normal exploration Star Trek show. It could be interesting, but, well, what's your take on Rikers in Space?
The Rikers in Space. I think it could be interesting, but I think you're right. If they did this series, I think we would end up with another TNG-type series. Mm. I don't think that it would be... I don't think it would chart any new ground for Star Trek. It would be the traditional exploration series, just with a different ship, but with some familiar characters. And... I mentioned earlier about the Federation concept, talking about having CG environments on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
There are some characters in Titan crew members
mm-hmm.
that would... There are characters like the Doctor, who is a type of Saurian, who would have to be done CGI all the time.
Right.
So there you have a main crew member who would have to be CGI.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you also have some crew members whose environments would have to be done entirely CGI as well. You have a water environment that would have to be done. Kind of like we had on Enterprise with the Zindi. We had the aquatic Zindi, who we only saw sometimes in these kind of board meetings amongst the Zindi. And they were there in the aquarium, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like that. You'd have to have something like that. So that would... it could be interesting. That would be kind of something new for Star Trek compared to the other series.
It
would also cost a lot more to produce.
Yeah.
And so then we get back into what we just talked about. How does the studio recoup the cost of production?
Yeah.
And how do they distribute?
Yeah.
I
think the expectation for a Star Trek series is such that they couldn't do it low budget.
No.
And they'd have to really do it like the movies, and to make it look like the movies would be really hard week to week.
Yeah, it would. And that's what people would expect. I am confident that people would expect it to look like the JJ movie
right
every week, but maybe with fewer lens flares.
I hope fewer lens flares.
Okay. All right. Well, let's wrap up this feature discussion here about the future of Star Trek on television. And we would love to hear your feedback, listeners, on what do you want to see if Star Trek comes back to television. And there are a couple of ways you can let us know. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use our form there and give us your thoughts, questions, whatever you have here on both this topic and anything else we talked today. And we also have a number you can call if you want to leave us a voicemail. You can call 646-652-TREK and leave us a message. And you can also find both Greg and me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, C-B-R-Y-A-N Jones. And Greg is Greg Harbin. That's H-A-R-B-I-N on Twitter. And Trek FM is on Twitter at Trek FM. And that's how you can reach us.
Yeah.
So anything else today, Greg?
No, I think that's a bit. I would love to hear people's views on the future of Star Trek. And If people just want to give us their quick ratings for all the Star Trek movies, too, I'd love to hear if our ideas are crazy. If people actually love Star Trek V. If you love Star Trek V, please write in and let us know why.
If you love Star Trek V, please let us know. And please let us know your thoughts on all the movies and your ratings. Yeah. Send us 0 to 10, 10 being outstanding, what you think about each Star Trek movie.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We do want to hear from you. Okay. Well, visit our website again, trek.fm. Get our newsletter. New newsletter is out. We have some exclusives just for newsletter subscribers. Right now we have Klingon wallpaper that's exclusive. Go to trek.fm/subscribe. And we also have polls on the site at trek.fm/polls. And last thing, you can try your Trek IQ by playing Trek Trivia at trek.fm/trektrivia. And you can follow Trek Trivia on Twitter. Just follow the username Trek Trivia, and Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis conduct live quizzes several times a week, and they want you to play along, and so do we. All right, Greg, well, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, it's been a lot of fun.
And we'll look forward to talking to all of you next week. For Greg Harbin, I'm Christopher Jones. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you out there.